Welcome to Health Hats, learning on the journey towards best health. I'm Danny Van Leeuwen, a two-legged, cisgender, old white man of privilege living in a food oasis who can afford many hats and knows a little bit about a lot of healthcare and a lot about very little. Most people wear hats one at a time, but I wear them all at once. We will listen and learn about what it takes to adjust to life's realities in the awesome circus of healthcare. Let's make some sense of all of this. A few weeks after I started as Vice President of Quality Management at Advocates, Inc., I attended my first board committee meeting. Advocates, Inc. champions people who face developmental, mental health, and other life challenges. They partner with over 23,000 individuals and families to shape creative solutions to even the greatest obstacles. Advocates says, first, we listen. Then together, we do what it takes to help people thrive. Midway into that meeting, a gentleman spoke for a full 5 minutes in what seemed to my naive ears as stream of consciousness passion. I thought, what is this man saying? Wait, everyone's listening intently. When he stopped, the medical director said, let's take a minute and digest what we just heard. Again, I'm thinking, everyone's silent. What's going on here? Then I stopped and thought, wait, he had an important point to make. After the silence, the attendees started with, I think I heard you say this. And then another one would say. After another 5 minutes of discussion, a decision was made sparked by the gentleman's comments. A good decision, a different and unexpected decision. After the meeting, I spoke with my guest, Keith Scott, who told me that the gentleman was a person that made use of Advocates' services, and that many, if not most, of Advocates' governance committees included people supported by Advocates. My mind was blown. Let's listen in to my recent conversation with Keith. Keith Scott, I'm really excited to be talking to you. I haven't seen you in a few years. I want you to know how important you've been in my education about peer support. I think about you often in the work I'm doing now. How do you introduce yourself usually to people?
Well, professionally, I just try to introduce myself as Keith Scott. Depending on the situation, if it's appropriate or desired that I use my job title, I'll introduce myself as Keith Scott, Vice President of Peer Support and Self-Advocacy. But generally, I just introduce myself as Keith and then just kind of, you know, see kind of where the conversation goes from there. If people are more curious about me and what I do, then I'm happy to answer any questions that people have.
Okay. Where were you in your life when you first realized that health was fragile?
I was in my late teens when I had my first hospitalization, psychiatric hospitalization. It wasn't something that I wanted, but it was something that, you know, my family felt was necessary at the time. I think it was through the process of that hospitalization and coming out on the other side of it, with things having changed for me significantly. Probably the most important of those changes and something that I've struggled with from that moment to this moment is, you know, the issue of needing to take medication in order to be well, stay out of the hospital, have a shot at a good life. And mm-hmm. I think that being confronted with that situation, it was the first time I sort of realized that maybe I don't know, maybe that I wasn't whole as a person without medication, or maybe there was something wrong with my brain. So that was probably the first time that I started to question that life was going to be different
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
Oh, yeah, totally. Keith, before I met you at Advocates, Inc., I was familiar with peer support, and I had worked in behavioral health and addiction recovery, not as a clinician, but as a quality management professional. But I would say that I didn't really appreciate the nuances and the opportunity of peer support until I met you. So I'm going to take a stab at what I think peer support is, and you set me straight, okay? Okay, right. So to me, I think peer support is that people who've had lived experience similar to mine, whoever I happen to be, and have reached some kind of equilibrium in their lives, provide informed listening, mentoring, guidance to people who are newer to the circumstances or are desiring to learn and grow towards more equilibrium. And that peer support system has also refined their communication skills, maybe their systems thinking to better serve their supportee. Now, I know that I've just given like a general definition of peer support as opposed to specific for behavioral health. But can you like explain it better to people?
Yeah, maybe not, Danny.
Oh, okay.
I think, first of all, I really like the term equilibrium. I've not ever really thought about, you know, kind of where people, you know, want to be in their life as equilibrium, but that really resonates with me. So thank you for that. I'm going to steal it.
Oh, good.
I think
I'm honored.
So peer support, you know, sort of most simply is one person helping another person, and there being some reciprocity there, and the platform, if you will, for the reciprocity is shared lived experience and this idea of mutuality, that I have something to give you, but you also have something to offer me. It sort of non-professional peer support obviously can look a lot like and feel a lot like friendship. Mm-hmm. I've had that experience in places like 12-step self-help groups and that kind of thing, where the playing field is relatively level. Professional peer support differs, of course, in that one person is paid often. Sometimes it's a volunteer, but the way that we do it, one person is paid. Mm-hmm. And the other person is not. And we try to be transparent about that, because what that means effectively is we can't really be friends. But the relationship often feels very much like friendship. Often there's genuine affinity between the two people. Often that's because of the shared lived experience, because I've been through things and you've been through things, and they may not be identical things, but they're close enough where I feel like you're somebody who can truly understand what I'm going through, what I'm thinking, how I'm feeling. And my hope is that you would feel similarly about the things that I'm sharing with you. And it's really not any more complicated than that. Mm-hmm. In fact, part of the challenge is keeping it as simple as that, because when you professionalize these kinds of things, there's a tendency to sort of want to define and manualize and regulate and provide oversight. And some of that is necessary, of course, but we have to be vigilant to not allow those things, those mechanisms, to start to pull what we do out of this realm of mutuality. And I think that's sort of the chief struggle that we constantly find ourselves in is how do we stay in this place of mutuality when all these forces are trying to pull us in these other directions?
Okay, so say a little bit more about the mutuality. So as you said a little bit earlier, that we both have something to contribute.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so we sort of come at this work with this idea that everybody possesses some innate wisdom about themselves, about what they've been through. I think sometimes we tend to sort of minimize that in ways that's not necessarily helpful, either to ourselves or to other people around us. And we want to sort of help through the relationship. So this relationship is built on this idea that I have something to offer you and you have something to offer me. The connection point is around our shared lived experience, of course. And what we want to really be careful to do, particularly as sort of professional peer supporters, is to not put barriers between us and the other person if we can at all avoid it. So by that, I mean things like the first barrier, of course, is that one person is paid and the other person is not.
Okay.
Above and beyond that, there are all sorts of things that the field would like to insert between the two people that's a potential barrier to the mutuality. And by that, I mean things like, if I were to read your clinical chart before meeting you, that's a barrier to mutuality. I now have information that's been provided by multiple third parties that may not be accurate from your perspective, that you might see as sort of a violation of the unspoken contract that we have between one another. The same is true for, you know, if I did assessments or evaluations, or if I write clinical notes, or if I have an opinion or an agenda with regards to whether or not you should or shouldn't take medication, or I have an agenda with regards to what you should or shouldn't do with your own money, or I take things like, you know, restraint training, which is often euphemistically referred to as crisis intervention training. Any of those things, I would argue all of those things, pose potential barriers to the mutuality that can exist between the two people, above and beyond the fact that one is paid and one is not.
Mm-hmm.
That's the foundation. And everything we do, again, we try to be really, really vigilant to not let these other things get between us and the person. And the approach from that point forward, you know, some people refer to it as peer counseling. We don't sort of see it or operationalize it that way. We don't give advice. We don't tell people that they should or need to do anything. The way we approach the work is to try to help the person understand that they possess this innate wisdom about themselves. And what do they need to be able to tap into that? And often that is information about, you know, what other people have done, information about what's available in terms of resources and, mm-hmm. and education in the community. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's about more than that. It's about having someone who says over and over again, I don't know the answer to your question, but I believe that you know the answer to your question, and I'm here to provide you with any information you need, support to access resources in the community, mm-hmm. or just to be patient and listen. And through that process, when the other person starts to understand that I'm not going to force them to do anything, I'm not going to coerce them to do anything, I'm not going to convince them that they need to do anything, the magic of peer support, if you will, mm-hmm. starts to happen. And what's key to this process is patience and kindness. In all of the interactions, it really boils down to being patient and to being kind.
Yeah,
to getting people to trust you in a way that they've not been able to trust other professionals. Because at the end of the day, I think what's really valuable about this is that the person understands that they always have someone that they can go to and that they can tell sort of the most concerning things, the most worrisome things, the most traumatizing things about themselves to get whatever help and support that they need. The worst possible thing for any human being, I think, is to be wrestling with something like wanting to end your life and not have someone that you feel you can absolutely trust to tell that to, and that they won't do something to you. They won't act on your behalf. They won't take away your personal agency to continue to make decisions for yourself. And I think that's kind of really what's special about this, is these peer support relationships engender a level of trust that is really difficult to replicate in any other kind of professional relationship. Because all of those other professional relationships have attached to them this responsibility to communicate about, not just with, but to communicate about. And oftentimes the way that that's done, particularly in the mental health system, can be extremely depersonalizing. The way we talk about people as, you know, the sum total of their symptoms, or we use diagnostic or pathologizing language to describe them and the things that they do and the things that they say. And so to convince someone that the relationship is different often can take an enormous amount of time. And we're prepared for that. We understand that it's a marathon, that it's not a sprint, and that many of the people that we attempt to connect with through peer support have had this experience for decades of not being listened to, of not being allowed to make choices about themselves, like nothing they've ever experienced before in the system.
This is a different angle on professionalism. You're just not born a really good peer support person. It's a journey, and it's trial and error. It's learning. And I don't know that before I met you and the work you've done, I don't know that I've ever seen such a learning environment. That's what you did, is a lot. I wasn't a peer support person, but I felt like working with you, I appreciated how much I had to learn. I felt like it was safe for me to learn about peer support. Everything you just said, it just, you know, it sounds ideal. Oh my God, if so many more people could do that, whatever their title. But how have you, and you're a mindful person, you know, that was my impression of you. You really thought about the words you use, the setting. How have you fostered that learning environment for people providing peer support or working with a peer support ecosystem?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. I think it's one of the things that I spend a lot of time focusing on. And that's just a continuous process, right? So when we hire someone to do peer support work at Advocates, we want to make sure that people are as trained and as educated about the role as they possibly can be, even before they come to us. An organization in Massachusetts called the Transformation Center, for the last, I don't know, 14 or 15 years, has been providing statewide training and certification for peer specialists. That's the name that they use specifically. That's 80 hours of training, and it sort of covers the basics, everything from how do you share your own personal recovery story to how do you deal with complex situations in which you have to perhaps confront a situation which is not supporting and nurturing a person's recovery process. To how do you help a person envision the kind of life that they want when they've been sort of in a system which is not supported or encouraged that, again, it's in some cases, decades. So that's where people start. And then into that, we add 40 hours of intentional peer support training. We do training for understanding how housing works, how the eviction process works. We do training on SSDI and SSI and other benefits like food stamps and Section 8 housing. What we want people working in peer support roles to have as much information and as many tools and as many skills as possible, because it's a complex system that we're trying to help people navigate. And the more skills we have, the more training we have, the more confidence we have in our ability to help a person navigate that world. In terms of other people not working in peer roles with whom we collaborate all the time, psychiatrists, therapists, senior clinical staff, people working in direct support roles, we try to offer periodic training. We do a presentation at all of our new hire orientations, which is a brief introduction to peer support. Mm-hmm. And this idea of recovery, to me, recovery just means, you know, a person moving their life forward in a positive direction. Again, I really like the term equilibrium, to try to find that equilibrium in their own life. So we do the introduction to peer support and new hire orientation. Then we do periodic trainings that we invite all staff to. Anybody in the organization, quite frankly, we want to have come in and learn about peer support. And then on an ongoing day-to-day basis, everybody working in a peer support role is constantly doing education and coming at questions from a place of genuine curiosity. So an example might be walking into a group living environment as a peer specialist and finding out very quickly that the house locks up the knives, you know, so there are people who are living there with significant mental health challenges and the house locks up the knives. And we feel like, we being the people in peer support roles, feel like the staff may be unaware of the message that conveys to the people that they're trying to help. And again, from my own lived experience and from that of other people on the team and people that we've worked with, that message is, you're dangerous. And when somebody thinks you're dangerous, that's not a recipe for trust, mm-hmm. right? Like, I really don't trust anybody who assumes that I'm dangerous and takes actions based on that assumption. And so when we're in that program, it's not as though we jump up on our soapbox and say, you can't lock up knives, you understand how damaging this is. We approach it from this place of curiosity, trying to understand ourselves better why people make these decisions, but also to try to use it as an opportunity to help other people understand implications of those kinds of decisions that they may not have been aware of mm-hmm. or have thought through. And so we'll say things like, help me understand why you decided to lock up the knives. And invariably what we'll come to is, and people are reticent to say these things out loud because I think they understand on some level that it's hurtful. But what they say is sort of in low tones, in almost a whisper, well, you know, these people are mentally ill. And that starts to open up the conversation about, so tell me why you think people who are diagnosed with these psychiatric conditions are inherently dangerous. And that sort of leads us to, you know, a larger conversation about what it is we're trying to do and why and mm-hmm. And how. Mm-hmm. And so we try to have those conversations over and over and over again, both because for many people it's the first time they've heard this idea, but also because the reality of the work that we do, the system in which we do it, is such that there's enormous turnover. And so the people that I'm having these conversations with today and tomorrow and next week will be gone in 3 months, 6 months, a year. And mm-hmm. we have to continue to have that conversation with a whole new group of people. So this is a constantly happening, constantly evolving process of educating everybody about what peer support is mm-hmm. and what it isn't. And to try to help them understand why it is we've made the decisions that we've made about how we want to provide it. Mm-hmm. And it's literally something that we deal with every single day, is how do we help people to better understand what it is that we do and why we feel like it's so important and why we're asking them to join with us around things like not using pathologizing language, mm-hmm. because it depersonalizes and it starts to treat the other person as being distinctly separate from us. And I think a lot of us interpret that as being less human than the rest of the world. Mm-hmm. And I don't think anybody intends to communicate that message. And so, you know, so we try to use that as a basis for a conversation that people want to buy into, because genuinely, I think people who come to work in this field do so because they have a strong desire to help people. And oftentimes they come to the field, whether they're even cognizant of it or not, because they've been in a situation in which this kind of help has been provided or it's not been provided. Mm-hmm. And they've had a difficult time as a result. So yeah, education and training and ongoing learning are essential components to what we do and take up a sizable chunk of our sort of daily activity.
Now a word about our sponsor, Abridge. Use Abridge when you see your doctor or therapist. Push the big pink button and record the conversation. Read the transcript or listen to clips when you get home. Check out the app at abridge.com. That's ABRIDGE.com. Or download it on the Apple App Store or Google Play Store. Record your healthcare conversations. Before I worked at Advocates and I met you, I had never seen an organization that had peer support sitting at the table of governance. And I have found in my work now that, you know, I often introduce myself as a two-legged cisgender old white man of privilege. I'm often invited or invite myself to sit at a lot of tables. And I feel like part of my responsibility of being a two-legged cisgender old white man of privilege is to open up more seats at the table of governance, operations, learning for people with different experiences than mine. And I've been inspired by working at Advocates and seeing that peer support has seats at so many tables, and that the people we support have seats at so many of these tables. How did that evolve for you? And how has that been for you to have a seat at the table of governance as a VP?
Yeah, personally, as somebody who's been involved in the mental health system for the last 43, 44 years as a service user, and for the last 33 years as someone, you know, trying to provide services from this particular perspective, it's always seemed clear to me that for the system to change in a direction that's going to be beneficial to the people that it serves, that the folks that it serves have to be involved in the decision-making process. They have to be involved in planning. They have to be involved in every conversation that is about their treatment. It is about their involvement in the system. Mm-hmm. Because if the fundamental idea is this thing called recovery is a personal responsibility, in order for, you know, anyone to hold someone accountable to that end, you also have to allow them all of the liberties and privileges and rights of everybody else. And that was something that was really clear wasn't happening. And so I've always had this belief that I wanted to be at the table. I know what it feels like to be in a hospital and have very powerful people in a room behind a closed door making decisions about you that you're not involved in. That's incredibly disempowering. Yeah. And again, it doesn't create a situation in which you trust the people providing your care. Because for me to trust you, I would have to understand why you would meet behind the closed door to decide my fate without involving me. Yeah. So take that on a personal level and then project it forth into sort of this professional setting in which I've been incredibly, incredibly lucky beyond words to work for the agency that I work for. The person that I report to, the person who hired me, a woman named Beth Lacey, who's the Senior Vice President of Community Services at Advocates and somebody who's been there for, I think, 32 years or 33 years now. She was the one who had this vision of providing the person sort of leading peer support and being responsible for integrating peer support at Advocates a seat at the table at the highest levels of the organization. Which when she decided to do that, not a lot of other provider organizations were doing. I think for a number of years, I was the only person in a role similar to mine that sat on a senior leadership team and had a seat at that table and had a voice that was supported and was encouraged. Because, you know, because it's one thing to get a seat at the table. It's another thing to feel empowered to use that seat as a platform to bring to light some of the issues that affect the people that we support. And I've always been encouraged to do that. I can't really recall any time inside Advocates where there was an attempt to shut that down or to silence me or any of the members of the team for that matter. And I think it's what's enabled us to fully integrate services to the extent that we have, and we still have a lot of work to do, into what we do at Advocates in a way that people felt that they understood the gravity of this, like direct care staff and clinical staff and therapists, getting this clear message that this is important to the organization, it's important to the people that we support, and it's so important that we're giving the person leading this initiative a seat at the table with the senior leadership of the organization. Mm-hmm. And I've appreciated the continued support over about 13 years now. I appreciate the continued support to allow this to evolve, to have difficult conversations about why we're doing the things that we're doing, and the support around like holding a line on not having peer specialists do clinical documentation, not having peer specialists administer medication, not having them control people's money, not having them, you know, read charts, et cetera, et cetera. That's been a difficult line to hold. Other providers have done different things, and we've decided that this is what we want to do. And I've had incredible support around that. To be empowered to grow the team from me and one part-time person 13 years ago to the point now where we have 35 peer specialists and 8 recovery coaches and a family partner, couldn't happen without the support from leadership like Beth Lacey and Diane Gould, the CEO. I felt incredibly valued. And over time, that's translated into the entire team feeling incredibly valued. Our former medical director routinely sent psychiatry interns to the peer specialist team to spend a day shadowing with us, to attend our team meeting, to learn what it is we're all about and why it's important at Advocates. Mm-hmm. Diane Gould, our CEO, I think when confronted with a difficult decision that she is concerned about with regard to its impact on the people that we support, will come to the peer specialist team meeting and lay out the dilemma and get feedback from people. And she genuinely takes that in and uses it as part of her decision-making process. And you can see it, and they can see it. And I think when you're doing that, you have an organization that's truly committed to these ideas and to these ideas being operationalized in a very specific way, mm-hmm. in a way in which like we believe is the most effective way to do the work. Mm-hmm. And so we spend a good portion of our time now actually collecting data and trying to justify the value of what we're doing through data, through outcomes, so that we can say, in fact, the way that we're doing things does make a difference. You know, language, for one, you know, I think sometimes I feel a little bit like people think I'm the language police or the politically correct social justice warrior. And that's not really it at all. It's coming from this place of understanding the power of language. Language generally shapes attitudes, and the people that we serve understand that. They pick up on it very, very quickly. Mm-hmm. And they see the difference between somebody who refuses to use pathologizing and diagnostic language and someone who doesn't. And people ask all the time, well, you don't want us to use words like, you know, client or caseload or super utilizer or patient or consumer. Or words like decompensation, you know, jargon that exists really only inside the mental health system. The point of not using that language is doing everything that we can do every single day to not reinforce that which is most dangerous in the psychiatric system, which is the depersonalization, the not seeing people as fully human, not connecting with them around shared lived experience, marginalizing them as a result, mm-hmm. and then them continuing to suffer as a result of all of that under the auspices of help, of mm-hmm. support. So we're just trying to help people understand that when you've gone through, again, years or decades of this kind of experience and you felt disempowered and you've given up on making choices about your life, every little thing that we can focus on that helps change the way that you see the people trying to help you is important for us to focus on. Environment is one of those things. When we operate programs, the building has peeling paint and missing clapboards and broken windows, or you go inside and mm-hmm. it's dirty and there's no art on the wall. There are no personal items that suggest that this is a person's home. when staff are in the office with the door closed and the people who live in the house are sort of isolated and by themselves for long periods of every day, those things are incredibly damaging to people above and beyond the damage that they've already suffered. And so we just try to raise that as an issue to pay attention to for everyone working at the organization. But the sort of the whole first do no harm principle, that's kind of one of the things that we really try to live by and to help other people to live by and work by in the organization.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Let me shift a little and ask you, so as behavioral health becomes more integrated with medical care and healthcare is getting more and more, or let's just say out-of-pocket costs are getting higher and higher, what kind of pressures are you feeling as a leader as a result of those external forces?
One of the things that we're spending a lot of time thinking about right now and trying to plan for is this sort of medicalization of peer support. Insurance companies are now getting on board and seeing the value, not always the full value, or not always the value in the context in which we would like them to see it, but they're starting to see the value to the point where they're looking to purchase these services for their members. And one of the things that we've been wrestling with around that is it's a great opportunity. We would love to be in more of the medical world providing this kind of support to people, but we're always worried about the cost of that with respect to the way in which we believe peer support services need to be provided and those potential barriers to mutuality that I mentioned earlier. Mm-hmm. One of those being a lot of the insurance companies want documentation in order to bill. All of the insurance companies require medical necessity as a justification, which naturally leads to diagnosis and the use of language that we find hurtful. And so we're sort of wrestling with this, like how much compromise can we make before we really start to mitigate the impact that peer support can have when it's done in as sort of pure a fashion as can be done. And so we're dipping our toes into the water here and there, working with a couple of private insurance companies who so far have been wonderful partners and have encouraged us to do this work the way we feel like it needs to be done. One of the chief things that we've really been concerned about is there are these opportunities for this to grow beyond the mental health system. And I think that could be incredibly valuable for a lot of people who never experienced these kinds of relationships. And we want to be cautious and thoughtful about the price that we would pay through those compromises. And does it take us to a place where what we're doing is not as impactful as it could be or I think that it should be? So that's kind of what's happening in our world right now.
Yeah.
I do think there is a lot to be learned from the medical world. My experience of being a patient, if you will, in the medical world is my medical doctor never makes a decision about me without involving me. Like never. I'm always engaged in the conversation about what do I want? What do I hope for? You know, how are my experiences impacting my overall health and wellness? I think oftentimes all we're asking for in the psychiatric system is for people to do the same. Whether you're a psychiatrist or you're a prescribing nurse or you're a therapist or you're a clinical person working in residential programs, that you're just doing the same things. You're not making decisions about a person without involving them extensively in their own care. And so I think there's a lot that the mental health system can learn from the medical world that we've not quite embraced yet. You know, again,
and vice versa, gosh.
Yeah.
Keith, you're one of my heroes. I have learned so much from you. We didn't work together that long, just a couple of years, but you really moved my work and my advocacy in a different direction. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you very much for saying so, Danny. You give me far too much credit. Your time at Advocates, I really appreciated your openness to these ideas, your willingness to seek me out. Like, I remember when you first got to Advocates, you reached out to me to set up a meeting to sit down and talk about what it is I do and and how you could be helpful to that. And I deeply appreciated that from someone in your position at the organization, really wanting to understand this better and wanting to understand how you could support it. And so, you know, you left an indelible impression on me as well.
Thanks, Keith. Thanks for taking the time.
Thanks for giving me the time, Danny. I really appreciate it.
Great. All right. Talk to you soon.
All right. Take care.
Okay. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Everybody possesses innate wisdom about themselves. I don't know the answer to your question, but I believe that you know the answer to your question. I'm here to provide you with any information you need, support to access resources in the community, or just be patient and listen. Powerful words. For me to trust you, I have to understand why you would meet behind closed doors to decide my fate without involving me. More powerful words. Peer support is patience and kindness. Even more. Let's take a couple of seconds and digest. No wonder Keith and Advocates have had such an impact on me and my activism.
See the show notes, previous podcasts, and other resources on my website, www.health-hats.com/pod. Please subscribe or contribute. If you like it, share it. Thanks. See you around the block.